Courtney Maja joins us now. She is a campaign manager at the Institute for Race Relations. Courtney, lovely to have you back on Mondays. And let's start with Neil. Your take on the whole NPA story of not following through on what appears to be compelling evidence.
Thank you so much for having me again, Alec. It really is concerning to see that there have been so many botched jobs with respect to prosecutions of very high profile cases with respect to the state capture. You had, as far back as August, I believe, the Ministry of Justice coming out and saying that state capture evidence itself is under risk because there was a technical issue with the database that may render the evidence inaccessible, which effectively means that all that money that we dedicated to the state capture commission of Zondo may effectively be rendered useless. All that money, all the time that was spent going into investigating those possible crimes, basically going down the drain. It really does worry, especially when you think about South Africa on the grey list and how we reportedly have addressed about 16 of the roughly 23 items that the FATF had required that we address in attempts to get off that grey list. But there's still some of the crimes, financial crimes, that we haven't dealt with. And I think there's substantial evidence to demonstrate that state capture is quite linked to some of those financial crimes that we haven't yet addressed, which means we could be on that grey list for a much longer period, because the government has indicated that the remaining items, the majority of them have been addressed, the remaining ones are quite sticky. They require a lot more time to deal with. So I am quite concerned and share the grievances that Mr. De Beer fervently expressed.
I was thinking over the weekend ahead of this discussion and having watched what Neil De Beer had to say about whether the DA did a clever thing by going into partnership with the ANC. Because there must be many people saying, but hang on, if the DA had rather gone into partnership with the others, in other words, the ANC only had 40%, and then started addressing the rot where it lies, we might have had, or we might have a better country. Clearly, this is academic at the moment. You can't see the DA pulling out of the government of national unity, and there would be all kinds of repercussions on the international markets were that to happen. But in the long term, would that not be something that somebody's thinking about? Because as deeply as the ANC influences are embedded in the system, it seems as though what Neil's complaining about might be perpetuated.
I agree with you in that I was and still am a GNU, not naysayer per se, but I'm doubtful of its success, initially for ideological reasons. But when you speak about the DA perhaps remaining in something like the Rainbow Coalition and strengthening their position, you know, consolidating positions of those different parties so that they stand stronger and mount a greater defense in the next local government election, it really could have changed South Africa sustainably, right? Because the GNU addresses a few of South Africa's hot button issues. But in the long term, we should be looking at building a side in parliament that can stand against whether it's the ANC or the Progressive Caucus, members of the Progressive Caucus, who I suspect if the ANC hadn't gone into the GNU with the DA, would have gone with your EFFs and MKs and other members of the progressive side. So I agree with you that had they remained in the Rainbow Coalition, they could have been able to sustainably change how votes are cast in parliament when motions of no confidence against a president are brought up. Although I should say that Palapala pales in comparison to things like state capture. And I'm not sure that keeping the DA out of the GNU on grounds of addressing corruption would have necessarily been an effective strategy, because they've only agreed to not support the motion of confidence against the president, but I believe they would vote against somebody, even somebody like a Minister of Justice, Simelane, who herself has had corruption charges made against her.
It is such an interesting scenario, and I'm grateful for your input onto this. Moving on to an interview I had last week with Celia Brink from Tshwane. He had some pretty hectic things to say about Herman Mashaba. And Mashaba, he was responding to Mashaba's interview with Chris, where he said that Joburg is in much better shape than Tshwane or Pretoria. What's your take on that? Is that just both of them playing politics, or where does the truth lie? The IRR does a huge amount of research into this kind of stuff.
We do. I think currently both the municipalities are in a lot of trouble. We've recently produced a report profiling the Gauteng looming water crisis, as we call it, just addressing what some of the problems are and what solutions specifically Gauteng residents should be looking at deploying to defend themselves against what could really look like Cape Town's own day zero, marginal escape of day zero. So I do think that they are, both the cities are in a substantial amount of trouble, although visibly Johannesburg is in greater decay than the city of Tshwane. And so I think perhaps for residents of Johannesburg, it's in a much worse condition just driving around Joburg CBD in comparison to the Tshwane CBD. There's a big differences as different as day and night, right? But I think there are still a lot of issues that both of those municipalities need to address, specifically with respect to the water crisis. So on that account, I'd say they're both playing politics because they are both facing very great problems should this water crisis materialize.
R.W. Johnson had some rather pointed things to say about it, that in a piece of his last week. He says Joburg's a dying city. It just doesn't have the water to be able to be sustained. And I guess the fact that governance is so poor would heighten that risk. With that research that you did, what would it take to turn this around?
So we need to increase our water capacity. Mr. Johnson is right in that South Africa is generally a water-scarce country. But one of the remarks we make in the report is that much like many of the parts of the world that are scarce in natural resources, you can make up for that with good planning and a good management of those very important materials. And we're just not seeing that, whether it was with load shedding or with the potential water shedding. The government is just not making plans for the increase in population, which Gauteng has substantially increased since the water resources were first built. So yes, the Vaal Dam is running out of water. South Africa's also just not had sufficient rainfall to carry the requisite demand for water, but also you've seen the Lesotho Highlands project, which was supposed to support the Vaal Dam, being deferred by about 8 years. This was a treaty between the South African and the Lesotho government that was going to see us being provided with water. Gauteng, Johannesburg really is in a lot of trouble. And what we're considering is some of the legal action that can be taken to compel municipalities to at least address the leakages, because the leakages are accounting for some 30 to 40% water losses. This is potable, safe drinking water that's just being lost to poor and non-action on maintaining the pipeline and water network infrastructure. So we're looking at ways in which we can begin to compel those municipalities to perform the requisite maintenance. You had one of the municipalities in Johannesburg indicates that of the 42 reservoirs they have in place, they only have a budget to maintain 20 of the leakages of those 42. I mean, that is unacceptable. So there's just not, there's a lack of political will, I would say, on the part of these municipalities to really address those issues. But it's a perfect time for residents to get involved. Water affects us directly, just as electricity did. And there's no reason for us to sit on our laurels and expect that things would change. We should really take up action.
Makhoni, bringing in Musi Maimane now, the leader of BOZA. Musi, I hear you on the line. I have Makhoni Maja with us. She's campaign manager at the IRR. And I'd like her to also listen in and maybe ping a question or two. But let's just go back a little bit, Musi. At one of the BizNews conferences, you were talking to us about HH Chilima and how what had happened in Zambia was going to happen in other parts of SADC. And my goodness, if we look at the Botswana election over the weekend, it does appear to be a triumph for democracy. Why were you so confident that this could happen?
Well, good morning. And firstly, I think it should be a celebrated result. And I also applaud the outgoing president, Masisi, for the way in which he's accepted the results. But I think what's an important dynamic is that most liberation movements fail the test of governance and the time period that you could kind of indicate that to is somewhere near 30 years or so. And when change occurs within a region, often you find it sweeps through. We can almost take a period before that. You can remember with Samora Machel, Yvette, Robert Mugabe, etc., was a period of liberation where countries were starting to be liberated. And I think as the region starts to recognize the fact that what the next fight is going to be is for leaders with strong governance records, it is natural that they are going to reject liberation movements whose main argument is that we freed you, almost as a thesis, but ultimately the danger is that they themselves become oppressors of the people, as you are seeing in Zimbabwe. So citizens begin to reject that after a number of years. And so we are seeing it. We saw it in Malawi with Lazarus Chakwera. We are seeing it. We saw it in Zambia. You saw it now in Botswana. And it is natural that even here in South Africa, whether you might be celebrate the GNU, but in some ways, there is a rejection by 60% of the electorate of the ANC. And therefore, that tells you that this wave of a change away from liberation movements is going to grip our region.
I guess something that also struck me about the Botswana results was that they don't have proportional representation as we do in South Africa. So the party that lost 61 seats in total, they only got 4 seats, the former rulers for the last 58 years, yet they still got 30% of the vote. Whereas the party that won, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, they got 37% of the vote. So not a heck of a lot more than the BDP, but they got 36 seats and, of course, the president. So my question really is, in South Africa, we have proportional representation, which in a way, I guess, might be, at this point, playing against the removal of the Liberation Party, which, as we were talking earlier in the program today, has still got lots of issues, not least, it appears as if you're politically correct, connected, you are immune to prosecution from the NPA. What's your thought on that, Muzi?
Yeah, and that's why I've been fighting so hard for an electoral system that affects more accountability, even at a constituency-based level. You are correct that Botswana has got multiple constituencies, and therefore, naturally, what that constituency-based system also assists us is that you can pre-coalesce. Now, I was involved in Botswana a number of years ago dealing with the Umbrella for Democratic Change, of which the UDC became a part of, the Botswana People's Party was a part of, and a number of parties formed this umbrella. What they could do is they could do it ahead of an election because they could say, you are strong in this constituency, therefore we are going to pull off all troops and your candidate can go through. We are strong there. Will you support us there? Which helps. And ultimately, even now, Duma Maboko, whom I know very well, had in the last election battled in his own constituency, and now he's gone ahead and worked harder back there to win the trust of the people, etc. So to me, I think it does pass many of the democratic tests of allowing every individual member of parliament to be held accountable to someone. Now, I think South Africa will never get to a pure constituency-based system, but we may get to a 300-100, where you've got 300 constituencies and 100 proportionally represented people. The other most crucial thing is that there is a direct election of the president, which SADC countries have. That's how HH got into office, regardless of what happens in some instances, some of the popular vote, because it requires them to be able to mobilize the parliament to pass legislation. But at least the president, whoever the president is, knows that they are accountable to the people first. So when coming back to the case of South Africa, yes, the proportional system becomes limiting in that even now, despite the fact that, sure, the ANC has lost the outright majority, it can coalesce to be able to reform that majority. But that doesn't need to be a permanent feature. It requires us to ultimately ensure that even if you belong to a party, let the citizens know who you are, directly vote for you so they can hold you accountable. Because Botswana, even if you may not even like who won or who didn't win, but at least accountability was effected in that country.
Makhoni, I'd like you to, I'm sure you've got lots of questions for Musi. We haven't got that much time left with him. But Musi, my big question for you is the ANC does appear to be operating just as it was doing before it went down to 40% of the vote. If you were still the leader of the Democratic Alliance, would you have done this deal of the Government of National Unity?
It is a very difficult question, because compared to what is the question, right? And I think part of the success of the GNU is reliant on the fact that the alternative, in some instances, you would then have to form a much bigger coalition that combines EFF, MK, etc. So I think I would have done, what I would have done though, is done it a little bit more differently. I would have forced the direct coalition with the ANC. But more seriously, if I was to do that, there are some policy issues that needed to be fought for, or that government doesn't stand. My greatest worry now is, to your point, the ANC, all it's done, it's lost its numbers, augmented with the DA and added a few cabinet ministers with the patronage that goes with it, and there's been silence. It is outstanding to me that the DA still stands strongly on the ANC, something they opposed, race-based legislation. They've gone for it now. They're defending it in all corners. A bloated cabinet, a bloated civil service. All of these, when I looked at the tabling of the budget this week, it may be a balancing act, but in all reality, it lacks a very strong reform economic plan. It's more of the same, to your point. It's not just around corruption that the ANC or anything like that has kept going. It's also about issues such as, how do we ensure that there's an economic reform? And I haven't seen any of the DA or any other party's economic policy finding any expression, even in the financing of the issue. So to me, I think if you were going to force the issue, you needed to make sure that it is foreground on policy rather than personality or party.
Makhoni?
Hi, Musi. Let me ask you a very direct question about the budget that you've just spoken about. One of the ways in which the Minister of Finance spoke about freeing up some 2 billion rand in the fiscus is by incentivizing early retirement of members of the public servants, which is within the ages 55 to 59. I'm wondering what your position on that. It seems to me that there's a storm that could possibly be brewing with respect to trade unions obviously getting ready to protest and march against that, which we obviously don't need in South Africa at present. I'm wondering what your position is on that specific idea of the ministers.
Yeah, look, certainly I think the protests issues will emerge from a different source, in the sense that the budgeting process in how it has factored in the midterm, some of the budget increases. Our fiscus is built on the fact that increases in the next number of years can only be at 4%. Now, were it to be that any negotiating agent in public service could go above that, then your problems could become compounded almost seriously. On the retirement process, I do think it's a welcome thing. You need to make sure that where best you can, where there have been people who have stayed in public service for too long and you want them to be out, it's a voluntary scheme, so people must be able to exercise that. And there are a lot of people who say they can't work in the current administration, etc., so therefore they are wanting to go. So from that perspective, I think it is the right thing to do from a budgeting point of view, and to allow for those who want to exit to go, and for departments who want to exercise voluntary exits, etc., to do that. Because in the same way as you saw perhaps maybe in the transition in 94, there were other civil servants who said, I don't quite like the new configuration, etc., I'm wanting to exit the system. Mm-hmm. They were allowed to do so with enough packages. And I think that's part of that moment right now that we're living through. My deep worry, as I said to you earlier, is what do we do in an event where a particular union extracts, particularly in municipalities, they extract a lot more than the budgeted 4% in terms of increases going forward, given that inflation is high, given that the economic challenges we're facing. I think you could see a lot more headwind coming that way because the state simply can't afford an increase beyond 4%.
Muzi Maimani is the leader of BOZA. We've also had Makoni Maja from the Institute for Race Relations with us today in that discussion. I would remind you all, though, Tito Mboweni tried the same trick and in fact, he made a huge incentive, and he even worked it into his budget that he would get many of the civil servants by incentivizing them to retire, that they would go, and none of them did. He had to come back the next year when he was finance minister and say, oops, didn't work. Well, if you've got a cushy job like some people have in government, and where urgency is not on the top of the priorities, a little bit like, as I said earlier, with David Shapiro, with the business rescue managers at Tongaat, urgency certainly doesn't seem to be on top of their priorities either, because the incentives are different. Well, then why would you retire? Why would you take early retirement? It's been the Biz News Briefing. I'm Alec Hogg. It's a great pleasure to be with you. From our technical producer, Ruan Erasmus, our executive producer, Lucy Ferreira, and the team at Biz News, until tomorrow at 7 a.m. Cheerio.